All right. GM, welcome back. So hopefully all of us are here for the workshop this morning. This is going to be about finding bugs, which is really what security is all about, finding and fixing bugs, hopefully. And this is an interesting format for a workshop. We are trying this out recently. So this is going to have 42 tips from the four security researchers that you see here. 42, why 42? 42 is supposedly the ultimate answer to all questions in the galaxy. So why not finding bugs as well? And the four security researchers here, I'll let my smarter colleagues introduce themselves first with Yuran.
Thank you. I'm a security researcher at Consensus Diligence, where I work mostly on tooling and automation. So you might have used a couple of my tools. But I am also a bug bounty hunter. So most of my tips today will go into that part of security research.
Hi, everyone. I'm Dincho. I work for the Red Guild. I'm a co-founder. We do security for the public benefit of the Ethereum ecosystem. And in the past, I used to be a lead auditor at Open Zeppelin for many years. And before that, I was a web developer and pen tester.
Hey, everyone. I'm Nat. I'm an independent security researcher. I spent 4 years at Trailbits, where I did mainly security reviews. And before that, was a blockchain developer for 3 years. So, yeah, today my tips are kind of going to be blockchain dev related and security researcher related.
Fantastic. And I'm Rajiv. So I've been a security researcher pretty much my whole life. Started with Ethereum security roughly about 6 to 8 years ago. Early participant in some of the leading audit contest platforms. And then for the last couple of years, I've been a lead security researcher with Spearbit Cantina. And in this context, started Securium about 3 years ago. So Securium was funded by an Ethereum Foundation grant and collaborating with some of the leading projects in this space. The goal was really to scale Ethereum security. Right, and by that we mean onboarding the next hundreds and thousands of security auditors to make Ethereum safer. So Securium is really an online community known for its boot camp. Check it out online. Has monthly quizzes designed by many of the all the people standing here and many others in the room as well. Check that out. And Securium also hosts TrustX, which is one of the leading Ethereum security-focused events. So with that, we will kick it off, right? The first question we really need to ask is why, right? Why are we doing this workshop? Why are we trying to find bugs? And as you can see, the whole, not just smart contracts or OPSEC and other things, right? The whole domain of blockchains, right, is really about trust. And in this case, finding and fixing bugs is really one of the biggest technical risks, not just in the base layer, in the layer ones and the layer twos, in the bridges and anything else in between, but also in all the dApps, right? All the smart contracts that really, and all the glue that holds them together, right? We need to be finding and fixing bugs. Why is that important? I mean, it should be very obvious to many of the folks, many of the security researchers here, but just to sort of put it once more, if we would like Ethereum to be the world computer, if we want to really onboard millions and billions of people onto the on-chain economy, and if we really want ETH to be ultrasound money, we need to make it ultra-safe, right? So that's really the goal here. So with that context, we'll kick it off. And this really sort of hopefully justifies it, right? I mean, this is from DeFi Llama, as you can see. And this is probably representative. It really does not capture all the other phishing and many of the other things that are draining millions and billions. So this is getting better. I mean, this graph sort of gives us a warm, fuzzy feeling that, hey, we may be getting better, but I think we really have a, long, long path ahead. So with that, we'll start with the tips.
Thank you. The clicker. Awesome. So all of you are probably on Twitter. If you're not, you're quite unique. And if you've been on Twitter and read any of the posts around bounty hunting, security research, you see a lot of grindset-focused posts. And I'm not saying hard work and dedication isn't what's going like required to be a good security researcher, but I honestly believe that going into security research with the mindset of, I need to grind so hard, work 16 hours a day, is the worst possible approach. If you look at other industries like doctors that have a similar kind of mindset where it's like, I'm going to work so many shifts, I work so hard. If you look at the amount of incidents that are caused by people working multiple shifts, it's insane. And the same thing happens for security research. Like, I'll be stuck on a problem for 4 hours at the end of the day, and the next morning I'll solve it in 5 minutes. Like, staying stuck on a problem just because you feel like you need to work hard, not a good approach. Okay, tip two. Scoping out targets and not just picking anyone at random is a pretty good idea when you're doing bounty hunting. There's so many programs, and if you just pick one at random, well, it can be a fun approach, but it's probably not that efficient. So probably the primary thing you should focus on is the amount of time that you have available. Closer? Okay. Probably what you need to focus on is the amount of time that you have available on these targets. So maybe don't go for like a bridge implementation or an L2 if you just have a weekend. And of course, like, if you're looking to make a living out of this or a significant amount of money, then don't go for projects that offer low bounties. One thing I actually look at a lot is not necessarily the height of the main bounty, which is like 10 million or 1 million, it's usually very high. I look at the bounty that's offered for the high vulnerability, because that's usually a really good signal about how much a project actually cares about security. If they won't offer anything for highs, or if their high is like 10K and their crit is 10 million, this is just like random, that's not a good sign that they actually care about security. They just wanna prevent the main things. Okay, tip three, try to sleep, sort of. Okay, so this one actually happened to me. I was trying to sleep and then, well, as it happens, my brain is like, oh, you were working on this problem, here's the solution. And so there was like in the middle of the night typing up a bug report. The idea here is not to try to work while you're trying to sleep. It's more so exploiting the idea that you have, like, your brain is doing passive processing while you're doing random things like trying to sleep or doing the dishes. And to really leverage that, it's important to not try to do too many things at the same time. So, for example, if you're bounty hunting on a project, don't switch to a different project. Just keep doing this one, go for a walk, let it process, and find some bugs. And don't go like watch Netflix and fill your head with different things, because then you can't like leverage this ability of your brain. Like, I have a cool example from when I was in university. I was working really hard on a problem. We had these days where you had to solve a challenge in a day, kind of hackathon. And I was like super stuck for like the first 4 hours of the day. Took a walk to get lunch. Passive processing happened. Solved the issue like right after lunch. TLDR. Take some breaks and leverage this passive processing. Okay, now some tips about how to approach bug bounty discussions. If you're doing bug bounties, eventually you'll have a discussion with someone, because projects don't always agree with the impact or what you found. Everybody responds differently. There can be some emotions involved when you tell someone their code is broken. So one of the things that's really useful is basically learning a little bit of rhetorics and preparing for fallacies. People will come up with arguments that don't work, addressing them, or strategies that basically derail a discussion. Being prepared for them will just make your life easier in the end. Another tip on bug bounty discussions is kind of taking the mindset of working with this project as a business partner that you might want to do an audit with later. This creates a style of communication that's much more productive and much less likely to result in a situation where you're just name-calling, like, no, your code is shit, and then they're saying, no, you can't find bugs and everything sucks. So this really helps things out there. And as an added benefit, if you actually do end up being business partner later, you have a much, much better relationship. Okay, then it's going to be super useful if you diversify your skills. So with DeFi, there's all these super useful resources like Securium that can help you become like a security researcher. But it's often easy to overlook the fact that learning other things that aren't necessarily directly related to DeFi or smart contract security is going to be incredibly useful. Like learning quantitative finance has been super helpful for me. Like there's a couple topics here. Like for example, learning how compilers work, I think is an insane thing, like insanely useful thing to know, because you'll become so much more familiar with how programming languages work, how Solidity works under the hood. You just get an intuitive sense of how these things work, and that in the end will help you understand code better, find more bugs. It's also just something that keeps things interesting, you know? Like some, after a while, maybe DeFi gets a little bit boring, this kind of switches it up. So it's also just something to have some fun. Okay. Now, some strategies that you can actually apply in your bug hunting process. I think one of the things that works really well is finding a paradigm and specializing in it. So, for example, in DeFi, you have systems that provide leverage. So what you can do is become super familiar with all the things that you need to do to implement leverage systems and what can go wrong. Once you know all these things, you can just quickly go into all the programs that have some type of leverage, see if they do everything right, and if they do, you just move on to the next project. So this is kind of like an approach where you go super broad, and it can be super efficient. What's important here is to pick a paradigm that is relatively unknown or that you think nobody else is specializing in, because that way you have some competitive advantage. I guess leverage and concentrated liquidity are a little bit old now, but I guess like various CK topics can be something right now that there's not that many security researchers that specialize in these, where there might be some good opportunities. And I just pick something that you find interesting, to be honest, because that's the best way to learn and go about this all. That was the go broad strategy. Now for the go deep strategy, instead of just going for a bunch of projects for one topic, you can pick one project and then go deep on that one. This is an approach I usually take because I have like I'm very time constrained. I do like weekends, like short weeks, and the approach I basically take is I pick a project, and then I take some time to explore it and identify all the like the interesting bits, the risky bits, the parts that I think are going to be super difficult to implement right if I were to implement them myself. And then I basically just go have a look at those, and see if they if they actually made the mistakes that I think they would have. And that's actually a, like a super time efficient approach when you think about it. And this kind of exploits the fact that as a bounty hunter, you're not an auditor. As a bounty hunter, you don't care about finding all the bugs. It doesn't matter. Like, it doesn't matter if something is left after you go by. As an auditor, that kind of sucks if that happens. But as a bounty hunter, we just want to find a bug as soon as possible. And this approach will allow us to do that. We will just have to look at like the critical code, the code that does liquidations. We don't have to look at all the like boring bits. Like usually you don't look at like the ERC-20 contracts, whether they do all the interfacing right. I mean, you could, but that's not the, the go deep approach. Tip 9, read the documentation. Okay, so design mistakes can be critical. People come up with interesting ideas that fundamentally don't work or are super hard to do right. And from reading the documentation, this has happened to me, this has happened to other people, you can already notice some bugs, and then you just have to go into the code to see whether like the bug you think is there is gonna be actually there. Quick side note there, documentation, usually out of date. Unfortunately, depends on how you look at it. There's going to be cases where you find a bug in the design, a bug that's been there, but they already like came up with something that prevented it and just didn't document it at all. Even if you don't find anything, reading the documentation will set you up for success because you'll have a good general understanding of what the code is doing, which is like the best foundation to actually get started. So if you like, when I do the go deep approach, actually the explore phase for me is reading the documentation first, because with this documentation in mind, like actually starting to read the code is going to be super, is going to be more productive because you have some contextual awareness of where everything fits in the big picture. Then, for my final tip, this is kind of a mental model I started applying myself, is when you are reading through a code base, you usually notice like these tricks or gadgets where it's not really a vulnerability per se, like even if you would submit it, it might be an information or low, but it's these tricks that allow you to do things in a system that are odd or usually not supposed to happen. And even though these tricks are kind of useless on their own, they are usually involved in what you would call a kill chain. So critical vulnerabilities generally aren't critical vulnerabilities, not single bugs, but they are kill chains. And kill chains are basically a sequence of steps or sequence of bugs that you string together to achieve a critical impact. And by keeping track of these little tricks you find while reading the code base, you set yourself up for success when you find an actual bug that's maybe not exploitable or easily exploitable directly, but when you apply your tricks, it suddenly becomes like a super easy crit. And just making a list or keeping a list on a piece of paper or whatever note-taking app you prefer, Apple Notes, could be whatever, just keeping like a bullet-pointed list, hey, I can trick the system into doing this. It's not a security risk, but it might be helpful. That's going to set you up for success in building these skill chains and basically escalating a vulnerability from maybe medium or high to a critical with a lot of impact. All right. With that, I'll give it over to Nat.
All right, just a raise of hands, how many of you here are developers? Okay, a good chunk. All right, so my next few tips, as I mentioned before, I'm going to kind of split between developer based and security researcher based, just because I guess I've been a developer for almost as long as I was as I am a security researcher, and it kind of ties into even my current roles. All right, so tip one is architect first, code later. There's nothing worse than as a security researcher or a developer than trying to fix your bugs and then realizing that one bug fix results in something else happening, which means you can't fix it anymore, and you have to Band-Aid patch another thing, and then that thing can't be fixed because you have to Band-Aid patch another thing. As a security researcher, that nothing is more dangerous than this. But also as a developer, it becomes really hard to manipulate your code, to add new features, to add behavior when you have new code that you want to add. And at the end of the day, it makes your code much harder to read. That means when you bring new developers on board, that's more time it takes for a developer to understand your system. And more time for security researchers in a review or in a bug bounty to understand what you're trying to do. I think this is probably one of the most underrated techniques, is just to really think about your code, figure out what do you want your system to do, how do you want to build it, identify the architecture of your contracts, of whatever your system is supposed to do, and code it later. And I know that's hard because even I tend to sit at a computer and just write code. But I will say, for a project that undergoes continuous development and continuous features, following this kind of practice makes just reading that code much easier. This is kind of related to maybe one of the previous tips. Document everything. I think from a security researcher point of view, there's so many issues that we try to find in code bases, and they're because they're either wrong assumptions or invariants that maybe aren't correct. The documentation might not accurately reflect what the contract or the code is supposed to do, but as a developer, putting the actual effort into documenting what you want your system to do, how certain functions work, what the expectations are, that can do a lot to actually helping other people understand your code. I think there's also been a lot of times looking at certain functions, certain code bases, and then realizing that all the documentation doesn't actually match the implementation. And then for security researchers, we have to spend a lot of time trying to figure out, all right, if that documentation or if that line isn't correct, what is it actually doing? It can help save a lot of time in order to bring people on board as well. All right, this one, I'm sorry for all you developers, but simultaneously test and code. I know tests aren't that fun to write, and I've been in that space, I've been in that mindset. But I will say that it does help you think about your invariants. It does forces you to think about how you want your system to work. And it forces you to actually test the outputs of your function, which you wouldn't be doing if you were just writing the function. You wouldn't necessarily be thinking about how a function is supposed to behave if you weren't actually writing the test with it. This can help with, at the very least, extending your unit tests, extending your test cases, such that, sure, maybe your test coverage may not be 100%, but it will be higher than if you were coding and then testing afterwards. It also helps to use this method to test for edge cases, because if you're forcing yourself to say, there's a function with an if statement that covers different corner cases, having a test for that means that you're also increasing your coverage there. And I think there's kind of a really useful use case for these unit tests is essentially finding bugs before your security review or finding bugs before your bug bounty. All right. This one is kind of related to what I'm saying before, is trying to automate as much as you can. There's going to be a lot of bugs when you write your code. That's already a known factor. The more time that you put in your development process to documenting, to testing, the more bugs you'll find when like your code is undergoing development, and also the easier it is generally to actually fix those issues. Such that hopefully when you get to your security review or your future security practices, hopefully there's less low-hanging fruit so that the security researchers can actually focus on the really fun technical, architectural, maybe even like protocol level design concerns, rather than we found another reentrancy here, exploitable here with this token. Because that's something you could find with a tool, and it would save you, it would maximize how you use your security reviews in a better way. This last tip for developers is kind of higher level, not necessarily in the weeds. Is proactively trying to figure out how can you increase security within your life cycle? What are processes that you could use in order to find bugs during development, such that your bugs that are found future in kind of the auditing side or the kind of further security side are the big ones. Generally, the smaller the code, the bugs have less impact within the system to fix. And so the more bugs that you find while you're writing your code, the better for your code. All right, this is kind of flip-flopping tracks because I am also, mainly a security researcher now. So I guess raise of hands, how many of you are security researchers or interested in heading that direction? Okay, then let's get started. This next tip is preemptively ask questions and preemptively identify all of the assumptions that developers are making. And this ties kind of into the previous recommendation for developers about documenting your system. Nothing is harder than trying to identify what did you actually try to build in the first place. A lot of the time, I'll look at a code base and then realize, yeah, that I think that's what was intended. I'm not entirely sure. Here's me looking at the code base. Here's what I think it's supposed to do. But it's really hard to have that clarification. And if you make a wrong assumption during your code review, I mean, you could be missing a bunch of bugs and issues within the actual code because you misunderstood how it was supposed to be used. So for that, I would recommend collaborating with your security team, collaborating with the developers. Make sure that you take the time and the effort to identify all the assumptions that you're making in your security review. And make sure that that's aligned with how developers intended to users to use their system. All right, this one is a bit of an overlap as well, but essentially as a security researcher, building a mental model of the code base is incredibly important because, and this graphic is from the most, I guess, Sherlock Holmes, where he kind of references thinking about like different concepts in terms of a mind castle, and where he can kind of figure out how to categorize information into this kind of strategic model that he can kind of be able to parse through information, be able to understand things, and then be able to bounce ideas. As a security researcher, this is super important. Just because once you have this mental model of whatever code base you're looking at, now you can start to understand, okay, this is how this particular flow works. This is how developers intended this certain flow to progress, and then you can look for deviations and assumptions where they might go wrong. A lot of the times, this helps with kind of taking a break, and then you can be able to really understand like different impacts of like different issues, and especially a kind of higher level view of the system. Understanding just like how the code base was built and how it works goes a long way. All right, this next tip is to learn your tools. As a security researcher, there's endless number of tools that you can use to verify whether developers are doing things correctly, endless number of different like fuzzing integrations, verification integrations that you can check things. And I think there's far too much conversation about which is better. I don't think that's a productive discussion. Instead, I think it's more important for security researchers to really sit down, play with each of these tools, figure out when do they come in handy, when are they most powerful, and really learn how to use them. I think there's also endless resources on how to use these, and at least for me as a developer, I just have so much fun playing around with these. I think the more you play around with different tooling and the more you play around with comparisons, fuzzing a code base or like writing unit tests on a code base, I think the easier it will be to test the code and playing around with the code base with these tools. That helps you in a different way because with code, then you can test the code base. You can kind of see, okay, what are the different branches within your function? How do you invoke certain like if statements? How do you trigger or revert, and it really gives you a good idea of how the system works. So I guess the TLDR of this is really just play around with as many tools as you can and see where they help you the most. As a security researcher, I've realized that how developers intended users to use their system never really matches to how users intend to use it. I think that's just because developers have an assumption of, this is the one flow that users are going to use, and it's just this is it. And users are always creative in terms of arguments or just like the ways that they call smart contracts. Any potential deviation in these two things can be a fairly big bug. And can result in like an impact in the system. So it is one area to look at. My last tip is to lean on each other's strengths. I think from a security researcher side, I was kind of sitting in both sides before, but as a security researcher, they bring kind of understanding of the security implications in the system, security kind of tooling and knowledge there. Developers usually understand how they want their system to be used, kind of the more strategic side. And I think for a security review, you can really take advantage of those two things and really collaborate with each other and lean on each other's strengths to maximize, or rather to shorten the amount of time it takes both parties to understand a code base and then to maximize the number of bugs you find during a review. All right, with that, I'll pass it off to Tincho.
Hello. Hi, everyone. Let's put the stopwatch. Thank you. Hi, everyone. Nice to see you all here. And thank you for coming. I know it's early. Some of you went partying last night, probably. Hopefully not too hard. So the idea is continuing talking about these tips for security researchers, for developers. Nice to see many developers in the room. Next time, perhaps you can put like security researchers on one side, developers on the other, and like we throw each other stuff or something like that, just to get it started. But anyway, yeah, let's be honest, okay? I don't think many of us here, and I include myself, we are not going to invent the next new big thing, right? It's probably the case that we are iterating on something that somebody else in the past built, or that somebody else in the past found. So it might make sense to learn from history and to learn from what somebody else found or what somebody else built to try to secure the thing that we are doing, that we are reviewing. So for example, you will find, particularly in crypto, that we are very good at publishing things. It's not usual in the rest of the security industry to public audit reports. You should take advantage of that. This is just one example of ciphering Solidit, where you will find basically a database of issues that has been that have been reported in the past by many security researchers across multiple platforms, auditing companies. If you don't want to use this, you can go, I don't know, Trail of Bits, I think, publishes reports, Open Zeppelin publishes, Consensus Diligence publishes, Sigma Prime does the same, and I could go on and on and on. So I'm not saying that you should read all reports like you read a novel, but probably you should at least skim through them. If you are building a new protocol that, I don't know, it's a DeFi lending stuff or some DEX or some whatever that you're building next, go see if there's some similar project out there that has done similar things to you, that probably the answer is yes, and go read the issues, and probably you will find cool stuff. Just to double check if you're not missing out on something. It's sad when we see in the, out there in the community the same and same and same issues being repeated again. So please, I don't know, take a look at this or many other resources out there. We already talked about this, but I just want to reinforce the idea, particularly for people doing security research out here. It's very difficult to understand to what extent you should go deep, to what extent you should go wide, and there is no clear answer. There's never a clear answer. My only tip here is whenever you are very much in the depths of a code base, be careful, okay? It's very easy to get entangled in, I don't know, line 250 of that 1,000-line assembly code that you're reviewing, and you end up finding something very cool that, I don't know, you can do something very unexpected in that function. But then it's very hard to sum out, because you need to find the actual attack vector. You need to understand impact in the project. And to understand impact, you should have context. How many times have you found something to then realize that, well, yeah, but nobody can exploit this? If you are a little bit evil, you might end up reporting that still to the developers just to fight with them, and they will end up telling you that, well, it's not exploitable. So zoom out, have context, understand where you are standing, understand the expected use cases. An issue could be an issue for you, but if the system is not actually expected to be used that way, I don't know, if it's not expected to integrate with that other protocol that you're thinking about, or it's not expected to use that token that you're thinking about, your issue won't make sense. So have in mind these kind of things. Diminishing returns are something that I struggle with. And actually, I have questions. I don't have tips. I will borrow tips from you if you have some silver bullets to solve this. I usually don't know to what extent I should be chasing down bugs. I mean, it will depend on the kind of engagement that you're doing, right? So I will talk about this later, but auditing is not bug hunting and it's not doing contests, for example. So to what extent you should be chasing down bugs? To what extent you should be going into that rabbit hole? When should you stop? Probably experience will tell you something about it. You will start growing some intuitions little by little on to what extent you should be going down certain paths and not choosing others. Then when it comes to reporting, doing proof of concepts is also a place where we lose ourselves as security people. How much detail should you put in that? How many, how much infrastructure should you be setting up to test that bug you found in that bridge with that connects 1,000 layer threes and fours and whatever? Sometimes it's very complicated and you might end up losing too much time on that. I've been sometimes like a week trying to set up a whole testnet environment to try out an exploit. just to realize that then when I reported, perhaps it wasn't the case, or the proof of concept, it's too complicated to run, or I end up debugging my own proof of concept instead of debugging the actual code that I need to review. So again, just questions to think about, things to consider. And then the last one, I'm not a very big fan of this new security contest, but some people in the room might be. You will find these escalation words. If you're not familiar with it, essentially, in contests, you will find people like competing to submit bugs. At some point in time, I think this is true in many platforms, but they all do the similar things, but not exactly the same. People will start fighting each other just to escalate their issues and try to make them more severe or to fight back the judges or whatever. And you will see like endless threads of people throwing shit at each other and spending precious time on that while they could be doing something more valuable for the ecosystem. But again, I've been in some cases there, and I know the feeling, and it's very hard to understand to what extent we should be doing it. But anyway, diminishing returns. Okay, diagrams. Yes, I love this part. As a security researcher, I'm a visual thinker. So that means that I oftentimes find myself like drawing stuff just to think about the things that I want to do. I also write a lot, and I will tell you all writing then. But let's talk diagrams now. I use diagrams to understand systems. And I do different kind of level of details in diagrams. This was me, for example, trying to understand account abstraction in the past. And I ended up drawing this. As I was going through the code, through documentation and everything, I was just drawing stuff and trying to understand what I was seeing. In this case, it's more kind of an architectural diagram. I don't know. I don't even think about it. I just write components, and I write names, and try to see which are the actors, how are the relationships. And this, at least for me, is very useful, perhaps for you too. So take a look at it, and perhaps you will find something valuable. Then I do some other things in terms of diagram. I could go into more detail with them. In this case, this was me just thinking about the DEM vulnerable DeFi. This is kind of a set of security challenges that I created. This is one of the solutions for one of them. So I was explaining this at DSS, and I used a diagram to explain the actual solution. So you will see me like doing function calls and usually drawing where are the fans and where we should be putting the fans and everything. This is just one example. In reality, probably I will be doing bigger things, such as this. I do go in depth sometimes. So this was me bug hunting in Lido. So in this case, I was reviewing mainnet contracts, and I needed kind of to create a mental map of how the contracts work and how they interact with each other and where are the addresses. And then I would use like, which are the EOAs. In this case, there's a multisig in there. And then I would try to understand how fees are distributed, and I also use diagrams, and I would try to understand storage layout, and I would also use diagrams, and so on and so forth, right? So you might say that I'm spending too much time drawing stuff and not looking at code, but this is just the way I think oftentimes, and I find this valuable. In many cases, I ended up finding bugs just by looking at diagrams and trying to understand how actors and contracts relate to each other. Or sometimes I end up finding kind of holes in my diagrams, so I realize that people can call things that shouldn't be able to be called. So yeah, and well, you can use whatever tool, right? So you can use online tools, your whiteboards in your rooms, in your offices, whatever that you feel like. Moving out of the comfort zone is another good thing that we should be all trying to do in many aspects of life, but let's just keep with security research. I just put that picture of that book because I like it. If you want to read it, then give it a try. It has a chapter about the comfort zone. So if you're a security researcher, probably sometimes you will find yourself growing experience in certain fields, in certain categories, let's call them, of vulnerabilities or even protocols. But sometimes it's good to do something else. Earlier this year, I was, I've been, for most of my career, I've been auditing Solidity smart contracts. So I don't have that much experience auditing nodes and infrastructure, for example. But earlier this year, there was a contest, I think it was on Cantina, for Blast. And I had the chance to either go for the smart contracts. I mean, I didn't have much time, so I had to choose smart contracts or go for the node, which was written in Golang. It was a fork of Geth. And I decided to go for Geth, for the fork. And I didn't look at the smart contracts. I missed all the fun that people had with the smart contracts. But I did have lots of fun reviewing Geth. And I learned a lot. And I ended up finding issues. And we did quite well. But I wouldn't have said that I was an auditor of Golang code. But I ended up finding things. And that only happened just because I moved out of the comfort zone and I started learning Go. I had never written anything about Golang. So I learned about it. I did a few courses. I prepared myself. I went in there and ended up finding things. And even if you don't find things, it might be the case that you end up learning, which is always cool. And the things that you learn, you can actually use in the next contest that you do. And little by little, you can specialize in that new technology that you're exploring. So I'm not saying you should always be doing this. Otherwise, it's like you are not specializing in anything. But every now and then, see where you can do something else. If you are a smart contract auditor, see where you can audit a node. Or the other way around, right? Just give it a try and see, and then you can tell me about it. So writing. I told you that I'm a visual thinker, but I also like writing a lot. Two articles that I recommend, essays about from Paul Graham that I recommend reading about writing and the importance of writing, particularly for thinking. I do very much agree with the idea that you only know something if you can write about it and you can explain it to something to someone else by writing it. And that's the only way I'm sure that I understand something. Probably if you follow me online, you know that I write a lot and I publish articles on the blog of the Red Guild. And that's the way I think. And I spend a lot of time writing. So when I do audits, I explain myself functions in writing. I take down notes and line by line, I explain myself what the function is doing. And in that way, I can find bugs. Because what I write sometimes doesn't make sense. Also, when we are exploring a new code base, it's the case that we explore many different lines of thought. But you cannot be jumping around many lines of thought, right? I'm single-threaded, so I can only do one thing, right? So I write down the other ideas that I have, and I don't want to forget them. So I write them down, and then I come back to them later, in the next day or whatever. And to communicate, I always say that doing security for me is, particularly for auditors, 50% finding bugs and 50% communicating bugs. You might be the best finding a bug, but if you cannot actually write a good report and communicate that to someone else and convince that someone else that you are right about it, it doesn't make any sense. So do learn to write. It's very, very, very important, and it's also somewhat fun. So I do recommend that. A particular strategy to find bugs, it's just sometimes going for what's not tested. What I sometimes do is essentially jump into a test suite, see which are the public functions in the contracts that are never called, and start exploring there. It's usually the case that whenever there's a public function that is never called from the test, it could be, yeah, it's sometimes the case that there might be something at least to explore in that sense. Then what I would do is that I take advantage of the existing tests. I modify them, I hook into them, I rework them, I bring them wrong, I do whatever I want with the tests, but just because I don't want to be building tests from scratch, right? So I want to reuse the existing test suite. That's why it's very important to always take a look at them, try to use them, run them, and see if it helps you. We could talk a little bit more about this. I don't want to extend myself. I do have some minutes left, according to Rajiv. He told me I had some extra time. So for me, auditing is not backhunting. Backhunting is not contest, and contests are not auditing. The skills, the mindset, the experience, the intuitions, the way that you play these games is totally different. And you might be the best auditor out there. I consider myself a good auditor in the past. And then I moved to contest, and I realized that people play a different kind of game in there. And perhaps I wasn't the best doing that. And backhunting is the same, right? In auditing, you will find yourself doing client-facing work. You will find yourself going deep and going wide and going very detailed and writing very detailed reports and talking a lot with developers, not necessarily discussing, but just thinking along with them just to find more vulnerabilities and bugs. And you have access to these developers oftentimes. You also feel the responsibility when you're an auditor, particularly if you're leading audit. You feel responsible for what you're doing, which might not be sometimes the case if you're just backhunting, right? In backhunting, you're just perhaps a solo backhunter. You're shirtless in your home, just doing whatever you want, looking at some code. Sometimes you look at it more, you look at less. You might not feel as responsible as other people. You can go as deep as you want. You can just get one win and you're done. Auditors might need to find everything. It's a very different mindset. And in contests, well, contests for me are just like madness. Some people find it fun. Sometimes I do. But again, it's a different kind of game. You should be finding sometimes specific bugs that are more unique. You should be thinking differently about how to report. Some people even influence judges. Some people throw shit at each other just to escalate their bugs. I mean, they are a different mindset too. So if you're an auditor, perhaps you're not a bug hunter, and perhaps you're not good at contest or the other way around, but choose your ground and know what you're doing. About to wrap up, so whatever ground you choose, try to be professional. We see lots of people on Twitter not representing very well the security community in many ways. So I always try to share with people these ideas of being assertive without being aggressive. Stand your ground, but not necessarily being aggressive with developers, being empathetic to them, and you developers with us security researchers too. We try to always be as thoughtful as possible. We take our time to think about the things we want to report, the things that we want to explore, the things that we share with you. Always putting as much attention to detail as possible. This is a big thing to me. Paying attention to details in reports, to the code when trying to find bugs. So being very thorough, being sometimes slow, and being thoughtful about what I do. And always trying to be kind to each other. This is the kind of the hippie part, but trying to be kind to each other and respectful. We are all humans. We have friends, family, problems. We can get very adversarial sometimes. But as long as we are respectful to each other and we don't bullshit each other publicly on Twitter, sometimes it could be necessary a little bit. But please avoid those bullshit reports on Twitter where you're just public shaming somebody that is not answering your report that you just submitted 15 minutes ago and it ends up being an informational or whatever. So try to be professional. We're trying to be a big security community here. Wrapping up, have patience. Everything takes time, particularly when you're doing security. Becoming a security researcher takes time. Finding bugs takes time, reporting, triaging, judging, escalations. Let's not even talk about how payment sometimes takes endless time. So yeah, it's a game of patience. Lots of people coming to me, what should I do? How should I get started? How should I find this and this and that? And what I always do is be patient because we are here for the long run. Rajiv, you're up. Thank you.
Great. Good to see people sticking around till the 30th tip. So people may be getting hungry, but I would request you to stick around for 12 more. There is a fun quiz at the end with rewards, which may be interesting. All right, so the next 10 tips, more memes, I would say. I would like us to zoom out, right? So we've had fantastic tips sort of covering both the security researcher mindset. Good to see developers as well, so covering that as well. And by the way, on that, we need more people in security. So if you're devs, then do consider not just securing your own code base and having that attacker mindset, security mindset, but do consider looking into security, getting into more of security as well. So in this case, the first thing is really both as a dev as well as a security researcher is to zoom out and sort of assess the protocol that you're building or reviewing, right? First thing is, I mean, look at this. So Billy, somebody hands him or her money, right? But would like to sort of take time to explain the importance of smart contract security. But of course, you know, YOLO, go and degen mode, look at what the assets are, put it into the vending machine, do some actions, and then, you know, make money or regret, right? So this is, I mean, this may seem like fun, but it's all about the assets, right? I mean, that's why we're here. All these assets are being put on the blockchain in various forms. What are those assets? As a protocol, you obviously will have a very clear view as a developer, but as a security researcher, this is the first thing you need to see, what tokens, right? Where are they being held? Where is it entering the system? And more importantly, where is it exiting the system? Because attackers are really looking to exit out of the system with these assets, right? So having this mental model documentation of assets is really critical. And of course, actors, right? I mean, these actors could be users of your system, could be abusers, could be attackers, could be developers themselves in the sense of, you know, all the code that's gone in and potential impacts, negative impacts as well. I'll get into more of that later. It could be even the governance, right? I mean, here we are talking about smart contracts in general, right? So it could be even the governance, and how does governance as an actor factor in to your threat model or trust model? So that has to be considered. And of course, all the actions, right? So what are the various actions that can be taken by these actors? When are these actions happening? When does it make sense? When doesn't it make sense, right? I mean, these will be very clear to the developers or the security researchers once in the context of the protocol, but you really have to zoom out and think about these very consciously. And how are these actions impacting the assets? How are they impacting the actors? And why does this all make sense? So that is at a 100,000 foot level. I think that is really what, this is really what security is about. So if you go back, I mean, those who are familiar with security theory, this is really what an access control matrix is. You have the subjects operating on the objects, you have the matrix of permissions, right? So this is fundamentally what we are looking at. All right, the second meme. So you may see sort of repeating or repetitive things in the tips that we've been talking about, but that, this is what we are doing consciously to drive these points home, right? As a developer, you may have an expectation of your ideal users, right? Or the users of your protocol, but the reality is going to be very different. And as a security researcher, this is something you have to pay, you know, great attention to, right? Again, users and abusers. How does this particular protocol get normally, how does it function normally? What's the normal behavior? But then that is fine. We need to build that model. But what we are looking at is the anomaly, right? How can this go wrong? Now, not all anomaly is bad, right? I mean, obviously, there are so many things that we don't intend to capture in the protocol, which is fine. And not every anomaly is a security issue, right? It's really a small subset of that is what we call as bugs, right? But really vulnerabilities that really impact the system, that affect the assets, that affect the actors, drain it out, and everything in between. So this is something that is super critical that all the developers should really be thinking about, right? How is this going to be used? How is this going to be abused? The reality is going to be, right, more than one user. I mean, the monkeys on the keyboard sort of an analogy, right? So really pay attention to this. And this is not just the users. I mean, this could be, again, extending to all the actors, right? It could be the governance as well. We've seen a whole bunch of governance attacks where it wasn't within the attack, the threat model to really consider something like that happening, but that is really what happens. And for the users, right, I mean, this applies really to every scenario. So as a user or a security researcher, one, I mean, we could expect on the flip side, a particular sort of a behavior from the developers, right? But of course, we have scams, we have rug pulls. So even there, the reality might really not match what our expectation is. So for all the users, developers, and the security researchers, there's really a message here. Great, so third one, third meme. Challenge assumptions. I mean, we are saying this repeatedly in different, you know, using different memes, different ways of saying it, but this is really the root of all bugs, right? The assumptions made by the developer about the user, the assumptions made by the security researcher about the code base, about the developer, the assumptions made by the developer and the security researcher about the users, I mean, all combinations, right? So this is really the root of anything that's wrong with security, right? So question everything. As a developer, question all possible scenarios, all the different ways that, you know, maybe you have a design, maybe you have a spec from your team, but how can this be used, right? How can this be abused? Question everything, every scenario, all that has to be captured within your model. And as a security researcher, again, question everything, right? I mean, ask, Nat mentioned, Tincho as well, about questioning everything to yourself and as much as you can to the protocol, to the developer team as well, right? Because if we do not understand as a security researcher, if we do not understand what this is supposed to do, how is this going to be used, we certainly cannot understand how this is going to be abused, right? So as much as possible, obviously, practically, there's obviously a limit. It's all time boxed. So figure out, you know, and this depends on the model as well. So if you're doing a collaborative review, you know, you have quite a bit of leeway in terms of asking questions. If you're doing a contest, maybe not as much. If you're doing a bug bounty, again, very limited ways of sort of questioning the protocol about every nit and, you know, nitty gritty detail that you may want to know about, right? But try to get an idea of who, again, actors, actions, assets, who is it, what is it being done, when and where, right? So that is really critical. Question everything. And security is nothing without discovering the misuse scenarios, right? Again, repeating myself, use and misuse, critical. And abuse is really a subset of misuse. So figuring out just the various misuse things is not going to do much as a security researcher. You have to figure out the abuse cases. And the abuse cases are really the vulnerabilities. We'll talk about the impact in a bit. And really to map out what the attack surface is, right? So for a developer, in this case, it is really to reduce the attack surface of your protocol, of your code base, reduce it so that, I mean, one way to reduce it is to reduce the complexity, right? Reduce the number of actions that can be done, figure out what is really critical. There is a concept called guarded launch. You know, maybe you can do it in steps. Various ways to reduce attack surface, because if you reduce it, then the potential for abuse is much lower, right? So the probability goes down. And your actors and attackers, I mean, we are in the blockchain environment, right? So in this case, we are really looking at sort of the worst case scenarios from an adversarial mindset. Anything and everything can be attacked and will be attacked, and by anyone who is a part of the system. So we are really looking at a very high bar, right, when it comes to who that attacker is. Unlike the Web 2 or the Web 1 world, we do not have a good idea of who the insiders are and who the outsiders are, what is the characterization of the normal users of my system. So it's a really adversarial mindset that should be kept in mind when you're designing, coding, and reviewing. Great. So severity, Tincho talked about this in the context of bounties and contests. This is probably more relevant for the security researchers, right? If we do not, I mean, we found a misuse abuse scenario, but if we cannot determine and communicate, like Tincho said, what the impact is, then it's of no use, right? I mean, it's probably going to be like an informational finding, or maybe a low severity one, but not much. But quantifying that is super critical. And the way the sort of the rule of thumb is to evaluate the assets. Are they being lost? Are they being locked? Is it temporary? Is it permanent? Does it apply to all the assets, or is it only a few of the assets? Is it only the fees, or is it the user assets? Is it, you know, can they impact assets that they own? Or can they impact assets of all users? There are so many ways to sort of slice and dice this, right? So that is critical. I mean, this, and the good thing is, I think the impact is objective. I mean, can be fairly objective in terms of how we determine it. But likelihood, which is really the probability that this can happen, that is trickier, right? Does this happen all the time? Does it happen sometimes? What are really the conditions under which this particular vulnerability can be exploited? That's really what we're looking about, right? Looking at. So that is hard, and typically what ends up, I mean, that's where all the escalations happen that Tincho was talking about. And these conditionals, there are a whole bunch of nested ifs, right? That if this condition is met and this, so you go on. And I think realistically, the more the number of predicates or ifs, the lower the likelihood, right? So figure out what the likelihood is, what the impact is, and use that to sort of quantify the severity of the vulnerability that you're reporting. And on the flip side, for the developers who may be sort of looking at these audit contests or bounties, right? This is again, I mean, if you're evaluating, if you're one of the judges or if you're on the team looking at any of these contest results or bounty submissions, this is something that you need to pay attention to, right? And it's tricky, but it is really important. Great, so for the Star Wars fans, it's really all about being consistent. For the developers, it's about being consistent with your checks in different parts of your code base, on the various assets, on the various actors and actions. If these checks are inconsistent, then it leads to inconsistent transitions, right, in your protocol. And those result in inconsistent state. And that is, again, the root of all bugs, right? I mean, these may seem very obvious, very simplistic, but at a 100,000 foot level, that's what it really is, right? So if you go back to the code that you're looking at, that you're developing or you're reviewing, look for these patterns of checks. Anything that's done in one place that is missing in other places, that is, you know, it's a big red flag. It's a good starting point. Right. So Web3, well, this is a meme adopted from Web2, right? And it's, I think I've seen it used in the context of dependencies where the small block that you see marked out as bug is really a dependency for almost everything that you run, but it is small. Nobody really knows about it. Nobody really knows when it was developed and whether it's being maintained. And breaking that, right, could really bring down the entire space. So in the case of Web3, I think it is very similar, and I think it's even worse, because Web3 is not a sort of isolated from Web2, right? It's really building upon Web2, and there have been many talks here that talk about the Web2 aspects of security, so we won't get into that. But the bugs in Web3 can be anywhere, and really they're everywhere at this point. So this may paint a very sort of red, nasty sort of picture, a very pessimistic outlook, but I think we are getting better, right? I mean, it's worse. It was worse. It also sort of signals the maturity of the entire stack, the entire space. But these are getting better, right? And as we do this, we are also adding a lot more code base, a lot of new infra, a lot of new tooling. So it's sort of a cat and mouse game, right? You fix these bugs, but there are new ones, there's new code bases, and there are new bugs in them. So for the developers, I guess the message here is that every line of your code base matters, right? So just be very conscious about everything that is getting into your code base. Try to see if it is really required or not. And for the reviewers, for the security researchers, read every line. That's not enough. Read between the lines as well. And what this means is, it's relatively easier to sort of find bugs in the code that you see, but it's much harder to imagine things, to imagine bugs in the parts that you don't see, right? So do that, and that even then it's not enough, right? So it's almost an unreachable challenge for the security researchers, because you have to read every line between the lines and beyond the lines. Beyond the lines is really about the dependencies that you see here, right? It's not enough if you look at what your code base is, but all the other code bases. I mean, we're really building the Legos of the future, or the financial DeFi blocks, the future internet, 3.0, pick your term, right? If you want to build that, then they have to work together. And if they have to work together, we cannot afford to have security issues in the glue that is connecting them, right? So that is the real part here. So in the case of Web3 smart contracts specifically, you may be looking at dependencies on oracles, right? I mean, dependencies on other protocols, dependencies on your web tooling. All those can have bugs and has to be within your threat model. Great. So next meme for all the Matrix fans here, bugs are really everywhere, right? They're really there in every code base. It's pretty much a matter of what incentives are, right, for the developers or the researchers to find them. So the message here is, look at what's there and what's missing. For all the developers, think like an attacker, right? The security mindset, how can it be broken? So that is really the sort of the repetitive message here. And for the researchers, obviously think like that, but also act like a white hat, right? We can get into more of those stories later on. I think Yoran had a talk earlier on with talking about bounties stories at the security conference. Okay, so this again is invariance, right? A lot of security, well, a lot of it in the smart contract space and in your code base boils down to invariance. Invariance is another term for properties. What properties should hold in your code base? What properties should not hold good in this code base, right? And these have to be consciously thought about, right? I mean, this comes up in the context of formal verification, typically, where you'll have to specify the invariants and then use a checker. But then even without that, as a developer, before you write a line of code, right, think about what invariant should this satisfy? What are the properties that I'm actually coding for? And document it. Great if it can be a formal specification, fantastic, right? Because then we can use formal verification tools. But let's even lower the bar, right? Write it in plain English. What is my code supposed to do? That is super critical for all the researchers and reviewers who look at your code base. Nat talked about this as well. Document everything, right? Put it in code comments, inline comments. Communications is going to be super critical in this space. And all of us are sort of repeating all this over and over again because it's really all these fundamental principles that apply. So read, as a security researcher, read all this. Hopefully the devs have written up all this. Ask questions. Be direct in asking your protocol teams or your favorite contest or bounty platforms. Ask. You may not get the answer, but it doesn't hurt. And ultimately, try to infer some of these if you don't get the answers, right? So that's possible as well. There's a fantastic area of research where you can actually infer invariants. And a simple way of thinking about it is inconsistent checks. If there are checks in some places and not, then it's either an invariant or those missing checks are sort of exceptional paths. So try to infer looking at clues in the code and docs and so on. All right, the final tip is just find it, right? I mean, we tend to talk a lot, think a lot, but ultimately it is really about reading the code, right? And the good part of the space is most of these protocols are open source. They have verified sources. So you can actually look at the code base, right, and know that, okay, it's hopefully the same one that was reviewed was deployed. Look at the code. There is no bug-free code. It may not be the criticals or the highs, but it may be the lows and the infos, but there are bugs, right? Read the code, find the bugs, and like all of us have said, both for devs and for researchers, I think success, we may think of overnight successes, but we don't see we see the tip of the iceberg, but there is a lot of preparation that people have done, right? People have spent years, decades, in different ways. Practice, and then ultimately patience. So I have the pleasure of also sort of summarizing a lot of all these steps. We'll do that in the next two slides, and then we will have time for questions. We have 10 minutes, and then there's also a fun contest. So quickly, right, for devs, before you code, specify and design. And after and during you code, test, right? So this is not, it's written as sort of a linear thing, but it's really sort of a cyclical thing. It happens, it's a helical model. So do that repeatedly. Think about assets, actors, and actions. Actions, think about where assets leave your system. Security mindset is critical in this space, both for devs and the security researchers. Shift left, which is a really well-known thing in the space. And all it means is that let's not wait for, test and prod kind of a meme, right? Think about security even before you start coding for the devs. Think about, that's really the environment we are in this case, right? Test properties, test invariants, use your favorite tool. It could be, the provers. We have some fantastic ones from the Certora prover. Use fuzzing. We have the Medusa from Trail of Bits. Use simpler static analysis tools. We have so many of them. As an example, Slither. And if you're more into bug bounties, you have various tools there as well. Use Foundry, use Solidit to as an example to look at some of the to learn from the past. Use Glider to look at things on the mainnet. There's just so many of these tools. Play around with them, right? I mean, some of them may really work for you, some of them not. And for the devs, obviously, the bug bounties and you know the things may not really matter for the devs. But all the various other tools, right? There are so many plugins for your dev environments. Use those to test it out. There are testing frameworks. There are various extensions. The key is to find your tools and your techniques, right? And there are, we are lucky to have a good choice. Think about the use and abuse scenarios. Think about the adversarial environment. Think about defense and depth, right? Because if there is any place where we require defensive programming, this is it, right? Do not assume that I have an array and it won't overflow, right? Or I have this code path, it won't be executed. Or nobody will create a pool with this weird ERC20 token, right? Do not make assumptions, right? And for devs in this case, won't repeat. We're out of time. We want to save time for questions as well. But all these things, right? And all these slides will be available soon. The video, I believe, is being live streamed. But the bottom one, I think, is critical, right? We tend to get overwhelmed, but take care of your code as devs from a security perspective, and more importantly, take care of yourself. Well, with that, thank you. Cool. So I think we have questions. We can take, I don't know if people in the room have questions or if they have used the tool to put it up here, but maybe we'll start with this.
Hello.
All right, the first one. What do you think regarding an issue in ERC-20 standard discovered in 2017 which caused $115 million loss by Ethereum users? Which one is this?
I don't. What?
This is a lot of transaction changing.
I don't recall that one. I don't know. Okay. I don't have a formed opinion about it.
Thank you.
Okay, while that link is getting posted, I think we have one that went up. How would you say your process is unique? What do each of you do differently from everyone else? Oh, that's a good one.
I would say my process is unique. I don't think it's unique. I think, I haven't worked with these guys side to side, but I do believe to some extent that our process might look similar. Sometimes I think we might differentiate in to what extent we use tooling, for example. That's one case. In my case, I don't use tooling very much. I'm very much a manual reviewer, but perhaps not Rajiv or Jonah might use some more tooling sometimes.
I'll go first. Okay, so I was very interested in this topic last year or sometime last year, like different methods of approaching bounties, audits, and there's a lot of different ways of going about audits and security research, but in the end, they're all not that dissimilar. I think Rajiv's last slide is just read the code. In the end, that's kind of what everybody ends up doing. Everybody builds this like general mental framework that they add information into as they read code, writing specifications, running tools. They are all just methods of thinking, writing another method of thinking about the code. But in the end, you're all just like mentally processing. So I don't think it's going to be super dissimilar.
Yeah, I would echo that. I don't think it's that different. I used to do a lot of my reviews with invariant testing and fuzzing, but I don't think that's atypical. I think if you put the time into really learning how to use the tools, I think anyone can really spin up like a fuzz test. It's really just a matter of kind of how complex you want to get with that.
There's too many tools. Should we pick that one? I think Nance had a slide on this. Doesn't matter which tool you use, just use the ones that work for you. I feel like that's very true. There's a couple of VS Code extensions that are super nice. I personally don't end up relying a lot on this kind of tool. I use VS Code bookmarks, super useful. But that's not really a security research tool. Obviously, you're going to use some syntax highlighting, go to definition type tooling. But beyond that is really like what works well for you. And I recommend you try out like all the different things. In terms of researchers to recommend, these guys?
there are a whole bunch. I mean, just go on Twitter, look up. And let me look at the publication, right? Which publication? So I would definitely do a shout out to Block Thread by Peter from Coinbase. So as a publication, so it's I think a weekly thing where all the threads in this ecosystem are very neatly compiled. So do take a look at that if you're interested. And if you're specifically interested in smart contract bugs, then the various reports from Qantas, from different project, I mean, well, different firms like Diligence, they all have, you know, whatever publicly available reports on their GitHubs. There is Solodit that compiles it. So those would be definitely some. There is a whole, I mean, all these security videos, right? Recorded talks. So there was a DeFi Security Summit, DSS conference last week, and I think we had pretty much most of the leading researchers in the space, Web3, Web2, anything in between, every aspect, right, were there. All their thoughts have been captured. So just go to those YouTube channels or wherever they're hosted, take a look at it. So that is something I would definitely recommend.
I found the link, by the way. You can find it in this thread if you scroll down the comments.
Okay, I don't know how to scroll down. Not in this. Yeah, maybe. Yeah, we'll hang around so you can show it to us offline as well.
I wanted to add something about tooling. I personally use Foundry a lot. Does it count as a tool? I don't know, but I write tests and I do fuzzing with Foundry. That's mostly what I do. And yeah, Visual Studio Code extensions and that kind of things.
Cool. Can we go back to the slide? I think there was just one slide we needed to show for the quiz. So while it comes up, so this is a short quiz. It's really 15 minutes. And you don't have to finish it now. Just look at the QR code. It's 8 multiple choice questions. There's a small contract which was designed by, and this was designed by Tincho. It has, for the devs and for the security researchers, there are some bugs in these contract snippets. So if you go to that link and if you use this password, you'll be able to answer the quiz. And the top two participants will get tickets to DSS next year. DSS is the DeFi Security Summit, the security conference that happened last week here in Bangkok. So hopefully it'll happen next year as well. So yeah, if you get a chance, do take a look. It's going to be open for about a day. And any further questions? So yes, thank you for sticking along. Any further questions? We are going to be hanging around there's one question in the room.
Thank you.
Can I explain the history of the issues that was asked regarding the ERC-20 standard? Can I explain it and ask you for your opinion regarding the issue?
I'm sorry, I don't understand your question. History of the ERC-20 attack?
The ERC-20 problem that was asked in this comments channel. The ERC-20 standard contains a security flaw that the Fabian Vogelsteller, the creator of ERC-20 standard, confirmed in 2023. It is classified as a lack of transaction handling. So the ERC-20 standard is designed in such a way that when you are trying to send tokens to a smart contract which is not designed to receive tokens, the tokens are lost permanently. For example, if you would send Ethereum to some smart contract which is not which does not implement the receive function, or if you will send the NFT token to such contract that does not implement the on ERC-721 reception function, it will not be lost. But the ERC-20 token cannot be handled on the contract's side. As a result, if you send such tokens to a smart contract that cannot reject them, they will be permanently lost. So in 2017, this issue was described. There were $16,000 lost because of this issue at that time. In the next year, there were $2 million lost. In 2023, there were $60 million lost because of this issue, because it is still not patched. And on 1st November 2024, there were $90 million lost, and 2 days ago, a user lost $25 million because of this exact issue.
Got it. I think we understand it now. So tokens sent to a contract being lost, right, as opposed to being sent accidentally to a contract, right? So I believe, it is how it has been designed. So users access.
Excuse me, why is Ethereum and NFT designed in another way and does not cause the loss of money for users? Do you want to say that the loss of money was designed?
I don't believe so. This is very specific to smart contracts, right? And it's nothing to do with the Ethereum base layer. And it also is about how your smart contract works, right? So we can go deeper into this. I think there's a misunderstanding here. So we can talk about this, but time's up, but we also want to take the last question in this room.
Thank you. Just very curious, perhaps maybe the three of you can describe how you approach a fresh code base, where you started, and like how do you map out, and what's your workflow like? Thank you.
How do you approach a fresh code base?
I already answered the question, I think, before. So me personally, I start with the documentation because there's going to be problems. Sometimes you already find bugs just reading documentation. I think I saw a Twitter message the other day where someone actually did the same thing, found a bug reading just documentation. And then usually global scanning of the code base. And then for me, I usually take the go deep approach. So I just spearhead for the parts that I think are vulnerable. But I think that is mostly a bounty hunting approach. It doesn't work for auditing. Or, I'll let others speak to that.
Hey, thanks for the question. So in my case, I would say, documentation first, with a healthy dose of disrespect for the documentation. Don't trust everything that you read, because it might be a case that in the code doesn't match the documentation, so you have found the issues there. And what I would also do is just, this is perhaps something personal, but I will just start with the little parts. I wouldn't go first for the big contracts where you have all the main interaction and everything. Sometimes I just start by the small libraries, but isolated things that I can then just treat as black boxes in the future in the audit. So I would start at the beginning with those and then move up into complexity.
Yeah, I would echo documentation. I would also add starting to find and identify invariants from the beginning. So I kind of start with that with documentation and then reading the code, finding some more invariants and kind of iterating throughout that process. I think over time, the more you understand about the code base, the more invariants you can find, and very likely the more invariants you can break.
Thank you.